WGR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. A big chunk of the country's feeling the major cold snap. Reporter Bruce Marcus is in Wisconsin, where temps there are hovering just below zero.
Temperatures this weekend are harsh.
If you even do anything at home, you got to cover up.
We'd like to go snowshoeing, but in this weather, it's still a little bit brisk for that.
It's brutal.
And how do you keep warm when it's this cold?
Shirts and flannels.
A coat and some UGG boots, gloves and a hat.
All eyes are on chilly New Hampshire, 3 days out from the primary. CBS's Caitlin Huey Burns is there.
Independent voter Dan O'Donnell says his vote for Haley is a vote against Trump. He asked Haley to assure him she would not join Trump's ticket as vice president.
It's totally off the table.
She told you it's totally off the
totally table. Very adamant. Totally off the table.
Haley said today she's staying through the South Carolina primary, where Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is trying to salvage his struggling campaign.
As long as I'm in the hunt, that tells me that I have that I'm seeing a pathway.
A member of Israel's war cabinet is speaking out against the prime minister.
Prime Minister Netanyahu's insistence that only military pressure will free hostages is being criticized in his own government. Member of the war cabinet Gadi Eisenkot is even suggesting fresh elections in the near future, telling Israel's Channel 12, "It is necessary within a period of months to return the Israeli voter to the polls and hold elections in order to renew trust, because right now there is no trust." Yotam Confino for CBS News in Tel Aviv.
For the second time, Alec Baldwin is facing charges for the deadly shooting on a movie set. Legal analyst Ricky Kleeman on what we'll likely hear in the trial.
The defense will definitely have experts to say this gun is not the gun that was the original gun. The original gun was so old that it fell apart when it was time for analysis.
So what will happen to Sports Illustrated now that it's fired most of its staff? Business writer Alex Weprin.
Authentic Brands Group says they are trying to find a new licensor, someone to take it on. So there is a glimmer of hope here that maybe the brand can survive in some form, but we just don't know yet. The question is, will someone buy it and will they keep it running? Will they invest in it or will they continue this slow decline that we've seen over the last few years?
There's a bed recall you need to know about so you don't get hurt. Over a half million upholstered platform beds made by the company Home Design are being recalled because there have been well over 100 reports of them breaking or collapsing. The beds were sold on Wayfair, Overstock.com, and also at Walmart stores. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Winter is an especially dangerous time for people with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. Mark Moran explains.
People who suffer from dementia face a host of increased risks in winter months. Everything from falls to getting lost, even in places that used to be familiar. And in the winter, the Alzheimer's Association's Lauren Livingston says low temperatures, ice, and darkness are just a few things that make conditions especially dangerous for people with dementia, but there are others.
One big one is wandering. That can be a problem for people living with Alzheimer's or dementia, especially in severe weather. They don't really understand maybe when they go outside that it's dangerous, so they might not put on any coats or additional clothing to keep warm. And if they wander, they may get lost and not be able to find their way home.
Livingston says keeping track of people with dementia in the winter is especially critical. Memory problems are hallmark signs of people living with dementia, but Livingston says there's another equally debilitating symptom called sundowning, which is made worse in shorter, darker days.
It can cause them to become a little bit more agitated in the evening time when the sun is going down, and with the sunlight being less and less in the winter time, it can cause for a longer period of time for people with dementia to experience the sundowning and be more agitated.
She adds that people with dementia are also more prone to falls, a risk made worse by snowy, icy weather. There are currently more than 6 million people nationwide living with Alzheimer's disease. There's no cure, and very few treatments available proven to slow its progress. This is Mark Moran. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine, highs in the mid-teens. For tonight, about 2 below zero under mostly cloudy skies. Mostly sunny, highs near 20 on your Sunday. For Monday, mostly cloudy, a high near 33. Winds will gust to 30 miles per hour. Tuesday, rain and snow, mid-30s.
Right now, it's zero.
Your home of the Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
And good morning once again. It is Saturday, January 20th, 2024. 1 year out. 1 year out from the day in which we're going to be inaugurating the next president of the United States of America. And we are talking in the last minutes of our first hour and the first minutes of this hour about this major case involving the Chevron doctrine, Chevron deference, before the United States Supreme Court just this past Wednesday. As a part of our analysis, our review, our exposition of all things law and government and the aspiration for justice in America here on our Saturday morning broadcast, always inviting your comments and questions at 844-967-2789, and also soliciting and encouraging your questions or inquiries online. Go to Civic Media, find your broadcast station, send us a note. Anya, Johnny, and I will be delighted to receive information and insight and perspective and questions from you as well. Let's get back to our discussion now about the United States Supreme Court. Again, a docket of the Supreme Court approaching very soon, 60 cases, probably going to be something in excess of that by the time the Supreme Court is all done. Oral arguments, 29 so far in this term of the Supreme Court, 11 more scheduled in February, 16 yet to be scheduled. And among those, once again, as we said in our last hour, this discussion just on Wednesday of this major case involving the Chevron doctrine and the future of our federal agencies and how we understand expertise inside our federal agencies. Let's go back and talk about how these cases get before the Supreme Court, what they're all about. They actually involve fishing, believe it or not. The justice is, again, considering two cases. Two sets of fishermen, one in New Jersey and the other in Rhode Island. Both of them objecting to the maritime agency's interpretation of a 1976 federal law. And what did that federal law say? It requires them to carry observers on board their fishing boats. And those observers oblige, of course, to ensure compliance with federal law in all sorts of areas. The question is whether or not the fishermen themselves are obliged to pay for those observers who are there to gather data to prevent overfishing and otherwise to ensure compliance with federal law. The contested interpretation, which was set out in a 2022 regulation, again adopted by this federal agency, the experts inside this particular area called the National Marine Fisheries Services, required the fishermen not only to transport those observers, but as I said, also to pay for them at a rate of about $700 a day. So the underlying question is whether or not they should be required to make those payments, and most importantly, whether the decision, the administrative decision by the agency itself, this fishing entity, is legitimate, and whether it should be supported by the federal court, and significantly, whether the federal court and now the Supreme Court should defer to the agency in making its determination about how to interpret this regulation. There can be reasonable people who disagree about this particular case, and I want to underscore that it is important. It is hugely important to fishermen all along our coasts. This is no small matter for them. That's the reason why it is there in the first place. Along the way, they have said not only do we contest the finding of the National Marine Fisheries Service, but we are also maintaining that the very principle adopted by the lower courts that said, you know what, because the law is unclear here about who pays for this, because it's ambiguous, if you will, we will defer to the agency, we will abide by its expertise, and continue to impose this payment obligation upon the fishermen themselves. That's how this is all important, not only inside the fishing industry, again, hugely, dramatically significant, but also for other agencies out there. Because if the United States Supreme Court says, you know what, we can get rid of this doctrine that says we should defer to that expertise, this concept, again, coming out of the 1984 case called Chevron, if we get rid of that, basically what it means is that federal judges will be the ones who are substituting their so-called expertise for that of the people we have hired in government to be the experts, to know what they're talking about. I'm going to talk about that very issue right now. Right before the break, I talked about Neil Gorsuch, who said that, you know, automatically, if you invoke this kind of Chevron deference, that means that the agency always wins. Interestingly, his mother, Ann Gorsuch, some of you may remember her. She was then President Reagan's first Environmental Protection Agency administrator. She was somewhat embattled along the way, other stories for another time. But she was in charge of the EPA when this Chevron concept first came about. Now the historical interest here, of course, is that Ann Gorsuch, her son, Neil Gorsuch, now on the Supreme Court, is about to decide whether or not some of the very principles that guided, if you will, agencies, even while his mother was in the EPA, and certainly agencies across the board since that time, Neil Gorsuch, son of Ann Gorsuch, former agency head, now responsible, at least one of nine people, responsible for deciding whether or not this concept will remain in place. So Neil Gorsuch, plainly among those people, doubtful that he will continue to support it. And indeed, an awful lot of indication that others on the Supreme Court, like Sam Alito, like Clarence Thomas, also publicly have cast doubts about the future of this precedent 40 years in the making. Brett Kavanaugh is also viewed as a skeptic. And then we've got the others on the Supreme Court. Let's talk about some of those, and we'll identify, based upon the Supreme Court oral argument of just this past Wednesday, where the swing votes may come here, and whether or not the tea leaves tell us that Chevron deference is about to be discarded by the United States Supreme Court. Well, what happened during the course of the oral argument? Not so much sparring. It was fairly diplomatic and civil. But along the way, the court's so-called three liberal members, again, a description that I'm not especially fond of, but it helps to identify, if you will, a general tendency, a general perspective, if you will, from some of the justices in the Supreme Court, just as we sometimes refer to the conservative justices. Again, titles, descriptions, and appellations that don't always apply. Nonetheless, among those three, all of them took issue with the Gorsuch position, the Thomas position, the Alito position, and Elena Kagan was perhaps among the most articulate among those three. She said, agencies know things that courts do not. Agencies know things that courts do not, she said, and that's the basis of Chevron. Take away nothing other than that from this conversation this morning. That's it. She went on to say this: discarding the decision would be striking it down and adopting a disruptive mode of operation. She said there have been 70 Supreme Court decisions in the past 40 years relying on Chevron, along with 17,000 cases in our lower courts based upon this notion of relying upon experts now subject to review and reversal by the Supreme Court. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson joined in that chorus. She said Congress had given some policy choices to the agencies knowingly and willfully. She said, and my concern is that if we take away something like Chevron, The court will then suddenly become a policymaker. That's Ketanji Brown Jackson talking about this as well. All that very, very significant. Along the way, Justice Kagan also proposed a number of hypothetical questions to the attorneys who are appearing in front of her and the other justices that day. She said, who should decide, for instance, whether a product is a drug or a dietary supplement? The answer, she suggested, was an expert agency. She's making this point that it's inside those agencies where the expertise lives and vests. She went on to say, it's best to defer to people who do know, who have had long experience on the ground, who have seen thousands of these kinds of situations. And, you know, judges, she said, should know what they don't know. She imagined a new statute, for example, addressing artificial intelligence. She said one that would inevitably, even if Congress passes it, would have gaps in ambiguity. She went on to say this, Congress can hardly see a week in the future with respect to this subject, let alone a year or a decade in the future. She went on to say, Congress knows that this court and lower courts are not competent with respect to deciding all the questions about AI that are going to come up in the future. Now, what did the other justices say? Well, again, it appeared that a majority of the justices might be inclined to get rid of Chevron deference and discard the arguments made by Justices Ketanji Brown Jackson and Sonia Sotomayor and certainly Elena Kagan. The two swing votes, it appears to be, come from the Chief Justice himself and also from our Associate Justice, her name, of course, Amy Coney Barrett. Chief Justice John Roberts asked one of the lawyers for the fisherman, he said, how much of an actual question on the ground is this? He was noting that the Supreme Court had not decided a case using the doctrine in years. And the attorney responded that lower courts continue to decide cases on Chevron, and that is a significant issue. The other significant tea leaf, if you will, coming from Amy Coney Barrett, who again could be the second member of the Supreme Court, who votes significantly to continue to adopt and embrace Chevron deference or to reject it. She said, concerned about whether a decision overturning the Chevron deference concept would give rise to countless challenges to earlier rulings under the doctrine. She said this, isn't the door open then for litigants to come back? Isn't this inviting a flood of litigation? And so the question in the end is, we know that there are probably three votes to support Chevron deference and to indicate in this particular case that the fishermen probably will lose on the merits, at least as to the Chevron application. The question is, what about John Roberts? What is he going to be thinking about this? And what does Amy Coney Barrett think about this? You add those two to the other three, and you've got five votes to keep Chevron deference, keep this appropriate deference in place. If they go in the opposite direction, if indeed John Roberts goes in the opposite direction, either one of those two, we have a significant change in the rule of law in America and another decision by the Supreme Court coming up probably in June that reverse, as we have seen the Supreme Court do before, 40 years of precedent and change dramatically the ways in which we understand the role of federal agencies. And if you will, compromise the expertise that we call upon civil servants to provide on a regular basis. When we come back, we're going to take some callers about these and other issues. Delighted to have those callers, those inquiries, those questions. Stay with us as we engage in further discussion about the rule of law in America.
This is the Shaw, WAUK.
We all have someone we love, like the favorite lyric in our favorite song. You can't imagine life without them. Cancer screening tests can help keep the person you love around longer by detecting changes before cancer develops, or catch it early when it may be easier to treat. And many tests are available for free or covered by insurance. It's time to sound like a broken record. Tell all your friends and family, I love you. Get screened. Visit cancer.org/getscreened to learn more.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
And we are back talking right now about what's happening before the United States Supreme Court, this major case to be decided in June, in which there certainly is some disagreement among members of the Supreme Court about whether to continue to adopt and embrace and tell lower courts, federal courts, the appellate courts, the district courts, that deference is a good thing in those instances where the interpretation by the agencies are deemed to be reasonable and rational and premised upon the expertise of those experts inside those agencies. As one commentator on this particular case said, in practical terms, the doctrine promotes a regime where experts do the gap filling. And the alternative proposal, that is, people who are interested in drop kicking Chevron deference, proposed by the alternative to Chevron is to have judges fill that gap. A judge who's not trained as a pilot, I do not want flying my airplane. That was a commentator in the wake of the oral argument by the Supreme Court just this past week. Again, this question about whether or not courts should defer to interpretations by federal agencies when a law is either incomplete, somewhat ambiguous, could have multiple meanings, who do you go to interpret best on behalf of the people of America how to understand that particular law? We've got callers. Appreciate so much your involvement in our discussion this morning. We go to those right now. We've got from Appleton, Cindy calling in this morning. Cindy, thank you for being a part of our discussion this morning.
The emails I am not an expert on this, but the emails that I am getting from a lot of my groups are saying that to overturn the Chevron doctrine would be bad for environmental protections, would be bad for consumer protections. And I think it's kind of giving the fox the ability to guard the hen house. But I'm thinking, don't the judges kind of confer with experts on the issues now before they make their final votes on stuff? I mean, is this just kind of stirring a pot that doesn't need to be stirred? Or I guess I don't know what understand what brings us on all of a sudden.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. Cindy, a great point. So thank you so much, because we're talking again about the consequences of this. Let me begin by embracing and emphasizing your first very good point. This is about fishing in the narrow aspect, but you're absolutely right. The application of Chevron crosses every agency in the areas of environment and tax law, consumer issues, as you just indicated, Cindy. All kinds of things out there, agriculture, commerce, labor, all kinds of things that affect our lives on a regular basis. Social Security, tax law, everything out there where you've got people in local offices, even area offices who make decisions based upon the interpretation of laws. And that's the reason why this is so important at a practical level. And then you've got your very important second question that is significant because it helps to reveal what actually happens when judges understand what cases are about and try to figure out what federal laws mean. So you're absolutely right. When I, for example, for many, many years was the chief of a civil division here in eastern Wisconsin, chief of a civil division in western Michigan, when we tried those civil cases on a regular basis, parties, both private and governmental, bring in experts. And you present them to a judge, and you have those experts describe the basis for the decision-making that they have done. And the reason why that happens, of course, is you do want to inform the judges. You want to make certain that they understand basically what is going on with respect to the case. And that's why this is also very important. It is not to say that judges should automatically, as Neil Gorsuch has indicated, should not simply say, well, this is the government's expert and that person should be followed for that reason. But when that expertise is deemed to be reasonable in the court, presented sometimes even in documents by experts, that's when the judges say, you know what? Those people in the agencies who do this on a regular basis, those are the folks to whom I should defer. And even if there's a disagreement about that, there's a contest about that, I shouldn't be the one necessarily substituting my own view for that of the people who actually are responsible for making decisions. And again, who are the experts who know what they're doing, know what they're talking about. And so while the issue has been out there for a long period of time, it has made our country work. It also, sort of implicit in what you have said, Cindy, ensures there's consistency, right? So that you don't have judges all across the country, each one interpreting a particular statute in a different way. If the agency across the board, across the federal government, every state in Wisconsin and California and South Carolina interprets it the same way, under those circumstances, you get consistency, which is also good for the people of America. So your point is completely well stated and well made. Judges do rely upon experts. The question is what kind, once they have made the determination that an expertise in an agency is reasonable and rational, that's when this doctrine says the federal judge should defer to that best, most informed, most expert-based decision of that agency. And so very important points in both areas. Again, I would underscore the first one you made, Cindy, as being especially significant. This is not just about fishing. This can indeed, effective June of this year, change the ways in which federal courts not only act, but in which we understand and have our own federal agencies do their work. Would also contemplate, arguably, as some of the justices indicated just this past Wednesday, an awful lot of contests. Amy Coney Barrett indicating not only cases from the past, cases from the future that are not yet before the courts, all of them coming in and relying not upon the expertise of an agency, but rather upon a federal judge to decide based upon what she or he thinks is best under the circumstances. Important point. Thank you, Cindy, so much for being a part of our discussion this morning. We also have this morning on the phone Mark. Mark, thanks again for calling in this morning. Always glad to have you a part of our discussion.
Yeah, first off, the whole Uvalde situation, it just points out the whole tragedy that we have to have this conversation at all, that there's that the open access of some of these firearms to people without proper screening, and that is just remarkable. That I think, you know, that Bill Ruger, you know, Ruger Firearms actually said back in the 1980s, no honest man needs more than 10 rounds in his magazine, you know, for the weapons. And of course, that got changed. You know, that now they got, you know, 25 rounds, 50 rounds, 100 round magazines. And that this guy was not screened out of the whole process before he got that firearm, those firearms in the first place. It just staggers the imagination. And in Texas and in other places, they want to loosen up the laws even further as far as how people can get these firearms.
Right. The attorney for the families actually just articulated precisely the point that you're making, Mark. Said, you know, he did say that, you know, the families don't necessarily need a 600-page report to tell them what they already know, which is that we need to get rid of these automatic, semi-automatic weapons. I've commented about it at length in the past. We all know, Mark, you know this. You've commented about it before. They're purposeful in one area, and that is war. They are intended to mow people down. There's no purpose for them in America domestically. They are weapons of destruction, and unfortunate that even these kinds of situations, whether it's Uvalde, whether it's all the other places where mass shootings have taken place, do not prompt legislatures, state legislatures, our federal legislature, which could take care of these things in a moment, does not prompt them to act. We know it will work. We know that a firearms ban of this sort with respect to semi-automatic and automatic weapons works because it did many years ago. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the Supreme Court. We're also going to talk about other cases pending in the courts, federal and state, of our nation. Stay with us for that additional discussion.
Walk. Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Dozens have died across the nation, and there are new warnings of frigid temperatures, some 30 below zero, and black ice in Wisconsin.
Freezing to the bone.
It hurts to breathe.
My fingers get very cold.
Days before New Hampshire's presidential primary, Nikki Haley is trying to fend off racially tinged attacks by former President Trump.
If he goes and does these temper tantrums, if he's going and spending millions of dollars on TV, he's insecure. He knows that something's wrong. I don't sit there and worry about whether it's personal or what he means by it.
Israel's prime minister is taking criticism over the Israel-Hamas war from a member of his war cabinet, the BBC's Mark Lowen.
Gadi Eisenkot, who is a member of Israel's war cabinet, and his son was killed in Gaza, in fact, and he has accused Benjamin Netanyahu of not telling the truth over his aims in Gaza of absolute victory over Hamas.
Anguish calls continue for the release of the Hamas hostages. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
It's the Packers and the 49ers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The NFL divisional playoffs, Green Bay against San Francisco again. Few expected Jordan Love to become the quarterback he is this early in his career, 49ers head coach Kyle Shanahan.
He's come a long way because he's playing at such a high level to get thrown in there early in this year and have to go through some ups and downs, which he did some good things earlier in this year too, but to not win all those games, kind of when you're with a tough record in your first year, the pressure that comes with that, and just to watch him each game, he's been consistent. For him to take care of the ball the way he's done has been unbelievable.
The Packers will face a 49ers defense led by one of the best pass rushers in the league, Nick Bosa. I asked Jordan Love how good of a job has his offensive line been doing.
They've been doing a fantastic job, you know, stepping up to the challenges, going against obviously some pretty good D-lines. So they've stepped up, kept me clean, and been doing a great job of that. And obviously our run game is excellent and high level right now. So it's another test, but can't say enough. They've been doing a great job.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine, highs in the mid-teens. For tonight, about 2 below zero under mostly cloudy skies. Mostly sunny, highs near 20 on your Sunday. For Monday, mostly cloudy, a high near 33. Winds will gust to 30 miles per hour. Tuesday, rain and snow mid-30s.
Right now, it's zero.
Be a part of the resistance. Check out the Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Monday nights at 7 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK, and on the Civic Media app.
There are 1,000 ways to say it.
Nope. Knock it off. Shut it down. Dream on. No dice. Give it a rest. Not a chance.
Or just
all text. You focus on the road.
As a passenger, you have the power to prevent an accident. There are 1,000 ways to stop a distracted driver. Choose one.
A message from CTIA.
Hey, son. How are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it. Navigating without a compass. Eyes waiting. Started to wonder. Metamorphosis. Loss of who you thought you was.
When your kid can't find the language, help them find the lyrics. Listen to the Sound It Out album and get tips and tools to start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
are back this morning talking now about the United States Supreme Court. Lots of things going on. Almost 60 cases pending right now before the United States Supreme Court, including this major case involving the future of our administrative agencies and the ways in which federal judges may or may not in the future defer to the expertise. It is what we see in the present campaign, an attack, if you will, upon this thing called the administrative state, the deep administrative state that actually doesn't exist. Indeed, our agencies, from my experience, 30 years in the federal government, filled with people who are committed not only to their mission, but also understand what they're doing, not perfectly. On a regular basis, government does, in fact, make mistakes. Important to understand that as well, but recognizing that expertise has its place in government and should, in fact, continue to animate what federal judges do, as it has for the last four decades. Some of the things happening before the United States Supreme Court just this past week and in another court related to that. We know very well that among those 57 cases or so that the Supreme Court has decided to take on is this challenge by Donald Trump to whether or not he should remain on the ballot, the primary Republican ballot in the state of Colorado. And you know all about that. Just this past week, Thursday, as a result of the briefing schedule set up by the Supreme Court, Donald Trump's lawyers filed their brief. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time talking about what that brief says. And then when the folks from Colorado who oppose Donald Trump's name on the ballot, when they file their brief, we're going to talk about that brief as well. His main submission in this extraordinary case with the plain potential to alter the course of the presidential election, the main submission by Donald Trump is forceful recitation of more than a half a dozen arguments about why the Colorado Supreme Court was wrong, about it gone astray in ruling him an insurrectionist who is barred under the Constitution from serving and even appearing on a ballot. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution, as we well know, Section 3 enacted originally to exclude former Confederate officials from serving the federal government, also disqualifies government officials who engaged in insurrection or rebellion from holding office. That's a summary of what the 14th Amendment, Section 3, says. That's the language that's being invoked in Colorado and other places all around the country to determine whether or not Donald Trump, number one, is an insurrectionist, number two, whether the statute, the language, rather, of the constitutional provision, as it is established, does indeed prohibit him from being on the ballot. So the Supreme Court heard this in writing from Donald Trump this past week. He said the court should put a swift and decisive end to these ballot disqualification efforts, which threaten to disenfranchise tens of millions of Americans and which promise to unleash chaos and bedlam if other state courts and state officials follow Colorado's lead and exclude the likely Republican presidential nominee from their ballots. Now, this case is going to be argued on an expedited basis on February 8th. Why? Why? Because many states, including Colorado, have votes on March 5th, also known as Super Tuesday. So oral argument coming up before the United States Supreme Court on February 8th. And all of that also going to implicate, obviously, what's going around in the country generally. In this connection, another small but not insignificant footnote to this issue. Maine, as you well know, the Secretary of State there had previously decided that Donald Trump should not appear on the Maine ballot. Her name, Sheena Bellows. The Maine Supreme Court this past week had decided to put that decision on hold. And so basically determined that Sheena Bellows, the Secretary of State there, had been forced under Maine law to issue her decision too quickly without the benefit of the high court's input. In other words, we're going to wait until the Supreme Court decides the Colorado case to determine whether or not the decision by the Secretary of State in Maine on that same basis is legitimate. A significant decision coming out of the Maine Superior Court. The court saying this: the secretary confronted an uncertain legal landscape when she issued her ruling. This from the Justice Michaela Murphy, who's writing on behalf of the court. She wrote a 17-page decision. And she said, That should be afforded the opportunity to assess the effect and application to her ruling of whatever the Supreme Court decides. That being, of course, the office of the Secretary of State there. So we'll wait for the Supreme Court to decide on this general issue, presumably very soon, probably long before many of these other cases also on the docket are decided in the weeks ahead. We have got a number of additional callers. Delighted to have you with us as a part of the discussion. Let's begin with Kristen. Kristen, thanks so much for calling in this morning. Appreciate it very much.
Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Kristen. Good to have you with me.
I have a question that kind of that harkens back to the Chevron thing, but
yes.
I'm sure you'll find a way to draw it into all of this. You know, I'm assuming that with all of these cases, there'll be numerous amicus briefs from different sides, citing different experts, right? That always happens.
Right.
Some of them seem super shady. Some of them are more legitimate, whatever. So if Chevron falls, does that relegate the agency experts to just using amicus briefs to try to get their points out there? Or will they inform the government's position on things?
That is a terrific question. The easy answer, as any lawyer would tell me, is we don't know yet, right? Just because we'll see what the Supreme Court tells us in terms of instruction down the road. But here's the point that you're making, which is very important. We've got a system right now where we know how things work, and we know how judges can, in fact, take information from experts from those agencies. So you've got these amicus briefs that you're talking about, Kristen, friends of the court, amicus, obviously the Latin meaning friend, all these people then writing in. And the significance of that would be, again, depending upon how broadly or narrowly the Supreme Court decides this case in the end, could in fact place all of this on the same plane and say, you know what, the decision, the determination by the agency to which it will still have access. And that's my principal response to you. This is not to say that the agencies will no longer be at the table. Frankly, if I were still litigating on behalf of the government, I would still have an agency official, even in a post-Chevron world, sitting with me at counsel table. The difference would be that deference, that understanding that would otherwise be vested in that person sitting to the left or the right of me would no longer be there. And we'd have to argue much more strenuously, as you say, as all of these experts come in and say what the government is saying is wrong, what we're saying is right, and requiring the federal judge, again, to make the determination, who, as the person I quoted before said, doesn't have that basis to know, I don't want to say who's right or wrong, but doesn't have the fundamental understanding to be able to pick and choose among all of these so-called reports, some of which, as you said, are going to be legitimate, some of which are not. Which one actually makes sense? As I think about your question, Kristen, I think as well about a related situation, which we have talked about at great length. You and I and in other environments, certainly on this show, other broadcasts, and other community events as well. The case involving Mifepristone coming out of the federal district court in Texas. There you've got a situation where the EPA, 25 years of determination that the drug, which is one of the two drugs used in abortion, providing abortion services, is for the most part safe and secure. Findings based upon continued expertise and analysis by medical people, by clinical people, by the chemists out there, by the biologists, all those people who make that decision. And there you've got a situation where the overwhelming number of experts say that, yes, indeed, Mifepristone is legitimate. And you've got a few of what you, I think, appropriately described as the less legitimate reports coming in saying, no, there are some real problems with this. And the judge in that situation, again, not really understanding this concept of deference, says, you know what, I'm going to go with those very few minor 1% of the total corpus of expert opinions out there. I believe the ones that are not in the mainstream, and I'm going to find that the EPA experts are wrong. That's the problem. That's the problem with what you've just identified as the result, if you will, of a Chevron deference no longer being a part of our jurisprudence. And we see that already somewhat. It's a little bit different application there. We see that already in that federal judge. And yes, indeed, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals also basically substituting, although for some different reasons, substituting its decisions for the decisions of people inside the FDA who've looked at this, who've studied this, who know what they're talking about. Getting rid of Chevron deference means, yeah, exactly right, Kristen. Now the judge has in front of her or him a whole great number of expert reports, some of which are off the scale, if you will, of common sense, others of which are right in the middle of common sense, and asking the judge to pick among those who doesn't, as the person I quoted before, doesn't know how to fly the plane. That's not being critical of federal judges, nor is it saying that the government should win in all cases. Understand that there's always this requirement that the judges have got to look and say, well, what's reasonable? Is the expertise being offered by the government expert, does that make sense kind of generally? Is it rational? You still do that basic threshold analysis. And if you come to the conclusion that this not only sounds right, but makes sense, then that's when you defer. And so, again, great, great comment, Kristen. Appreciate that very, very much. And plainly, we will talk more about how that plays out in the future. Again, I think one of the most important cases for the Supreme Court this term. Tim on the line. We've also got Tim calling in this morning. Tim, we appreciate your comment or question as well.
Okay, on the Chevron thing.
Yes.
You had mentioned that when these inspectors or whatever go on a boat or a ship or whatever, that the fisherman has to pay.
Yes.
Well, who decided that the fisherman has to pay? Why do they have to pay? I guess I don't understand that.
Sure, Tim. And you know what? That is such a good question, because that's exactly what the litigation is out about at core. And you know what? That's the kind of thing that, again, reasonable people might differ on, right? And so, again, as I said, not only is your question a good one, but the question as you raise it is precisely what the fishermen are indicating is problematic. And they're saying, you know what? The interpretation given this particular statute that is not clear. Right now, the decision is made by the agency, the people who have worked on this area on a regular basis, who presumably have engaged with the on the issue on a regular basis. That issue is precisely what the case is at core about. And the reason why people can differ on that underscores, again, the importance of this Chevron issue generally, because you can make a different decision on that. You can decide about it. The agency can decide, yes, indeed, you do make that. You have to make the payment as a fisherman, or you don't have to make the payment as a fisherman. The question is, frankly, even larger than that. It is about whether or not the federal court in deciding that will defer to the agency and make that determination. Right now, to answer your question very squarely, it is the agency that has said, yes, indeed, we believe, based upon our interpretation, our years of experience, that this payment should be made. That issue, again, is before the courts, and that substantive issue will be decided one way or the other. The larger issue is, how do you get there? Do you defer to the agency, and in that case, the fishermen lose, or do you dropkick? Do you get rid of Chevron deference and put the federal judge in charge of making that decision at all? Tim, great observation about the practicalities of this particular case. Again, for reference, Raimondo, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, and Relentless versus Department of Commerce, both of those cases now before the Supreme Court, now being drafted and probably will be issued by the Supreme Court in May, probably even more likely in June of this year, arguably changing the way in which we understand the role of federal agencies in America. Lots going on in front of the United States Supreme Court. Again, the brief being filed by former President Trump, arguing that he should, in fact, appear on the Colorado ballot. And in Maine, the Maine court there saying that the decision by the Secretary of State will stay that until the Supreme Court tells us about what happens in Colorado. All of that related to the Constitution of our nation. When we come back, a little bit more about what's going on in the courts of our nation. Stay with us for that discussion.
The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Mean Gene Okerlund, and I'm talking with Brett Uhlberg, owner of Robert Half Diamonds. Brett, I hear you pay cash for gold.
Not only gold, but silver, diamonds in any form like jewelry, teeth, coins, flatware.
Why should I sell you my gold?
Why not? Our store is the only store that recommends you shop around before you sell. This way you know you're getting the most money. But if Robert Half Diamonds can't beat a competitor's offer on your scrap gold, we'll give you $20 just for letting us try.
Hey, what if I'm shy?
You? Well, at Robert Half Diamonds, we sit with you at a table. We go through your items and make you an offer. You're not pressured, and we offer more on jewelry that we can resell.
Can I trade my gold for a new piece of jewelry?
Of course you can, and not only that, we can custom make a piece of jewelry using your gold and gems.
Hey, there you have it, folks. Sell your gold to my friends at Robert Half Diamonds. Visit them on 76th and Layton in Greenfield. Robert Half Diamonds, where they want your business.
This is The Shaw, WAUK.
And we are back in our Saturday morning discussion. We're going to do in the final moments of our time together this Saturday, we sometimes call rule of law snapshots, not to indicate they're not important, but significant things that have happened in recent days, recent weeks, about which we should all be aware. We're talking a lot about, obviously, January 6th insurrection issues this morning, as we have before. From time to time, I do note, among the approximately 1,200 people who have been investigated and charged with offenses related to the attack on the Capitol, the exact number, 1,265, just over a third of those, 440 were charged with assaulting or impeding law enforcement officers. And indeed, just this past week, a Florida man was sentenced to 5 years in prison for assaulting at least six police officers during that January 6th riot. His name is Kenneth Bonowitz. He's 58. He's from Pompano Beach. And in court papers, he was described by the government as one of the most violent January 6th rioters. He was sentenced to 36 months of supervised release beyond this five-year sentence. Fined also $2,000 by Judge Gia Cobb of the U.S. District Court there in Washington, D.C. In a span of 10 seconds, this defendant assaulted four officers by shoving, pushing, and punching them, as well as placing one officer in a chokehold and lifting her off the ground. Bonowitz did not stop his attacks until officers sprayed a chemical agent on his face. And after that spraying happened, he was interviewed on videotape and gave an account of what happened. A reporter asked for his name and provenance, and he responded, Ken Bonowitz, Florida. Very proud, apparently, of what he had done that day. Significant to note that these defendants continue to be not only convicted, but also sentenced to significant terms of imprisonment in our federal prisons for these kinds of violent attacks upon our Capitol. We also know related to January 6th, this continuing focus on false electors, not violent in the physical manner that a Kenneth Bonowitz would be convicted of and sentenced for this past week, but plainly involving in many ways in different states this attempt to try to overturn the vote of the populations in at least seven states where the votes were contested. We know already when it comes to these fake electors who put together various forms of representations that they were the proper electors under the Electoral College. We know that in at least three states, they have been charged criminally for that conduct. These documents being sent to Washington, D.C. with their intention that they be counted by our Speaker of the House and our Vice President at the time did not happen. We know that the count was properly done, but only after our Capitol was attacked. This attempt, again, a part of the omnibus attempt to overthrow the results of the 2020 election. In December, we know a Nevada grand jury indicted six people with felony charges of offering these false instruments. They are pending right now. We know in Michigan, the attorney general also filed felony charges in July of 2023, just last year, against 16 fake electors, one of whom is now cooperating with Michigan authorities. We know, of course, case in Georgia, three fake electors have been charged along with others in this omnibus RICO conspiracy there as well. Well, just recently, the Nevada top prosecutor, the attorney general there, said this. It's important to understand what's going on. He said that the fake electors in that state will not be charged, but noted this. He said, I'm going to seek changes in Nevada law and process to ensure that in the future, this kind of conduct can be prosecuted. Why? He said, because in the particular documents that the fake electors issued in that particular jurisdiction in New Mexico, unlike the documents in other places, including the state of Wisconsin, that language had the documents had some language, a caveat, if you will, saying that's conditional, and that they were submitted in case only in the event that these electors were later recognized as duly elected qualified electors. Now, we can still argue about whether or not that's proper, but the attorney general there is saying that the particular fake elector documents there, because they had this conditional language, basically indicate that they were conditional in nature with this caveat and therefore not inclined to charge them under Nevada law with the intent to violate the state law there. A difference from other places like Nevada and in Michigan and in Georgia, in New Mexico, because of the specific facts there, distinguishing from those other charges. In Wisconsin, as I said, the fake electors in our state signed off on documents like those documents in the cases where they have been charged. No such language in those documents coming out of the state of Wisconsin. Fake electors obviously continuing to be a significant portion of this overall look and review and prosecution involving January 6th. Finally, let's talk a little bit more about another major case going ahead. Trial continuing on Monday of this coming week. This is the lawsuit brought by E. Jean Carroll, the writer, principally in New York, but has a national reputation, a national readership out there. And she alleges and has alleged, both in writing and orally, that in the mid-1990s, Donald Trump sexually assaulted her in an apartment store in Manhattan. And in the wake of that, she wrote about it. She described it. And while the former president was the president, while he was in office, he indicated that she lied about it, that he doesn't know this woman, that she made this all up. And those statements that he made were the basis of an initial lawsuit that she brought, alleging that because of the things that he said, he had basically defamed her. That case, believe it or not, has been stayed while the federal issues resolve about whether or not Donald Trump was immune from that kind of civil lawsuit, if you will, while he's the president. All of that now resolved. Now going ahead, a second lawsuit going ahead in a federal district court in New York City. The case being tried just this past week. Compelling testimony by E. Jean Carroll herself about what happened. The judge, Lewis Kaplan, also engaging back and forth with Donald Trump from the bench, even as Donald Trump is attending. The jury hearing all of this evidence will, again, in this second trial, now determining the amount of damages that Donald Trump will have to pay for the defamation that's previously been proven. And significantly, the former president indicating that he may well appear once again on Monday as this trial goes ahead and may indeed testify. And when he testifies, of course, in a civil proceeding, he has the right to do that. Doesn't oblige to do it, but has the right to do it. Also subject, of course, to cross-examination. We will see what the jury does in that particular case. E. Jean Carroll seeking at least $10 million in damages for his denials that he sexually assaulted her and engaged in this kind of defamation. We will continue to talk about that and many other cases here in the Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining me on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Join me every Saturday for this discussion, and have a good week, everybody.
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Governor Evers lays out his priorities for 2024 when he delivers his State of the State address. I'm News Director Terry Bell. Join Civic Media's Todd Albaugh and me as we bring you the governor's speech live, right here, Tuesday night at 7, followed by the Republican response. Todd and I will help you understand what it means for you, your family, and your community. Join us for the governor's State of the State address, Tuesday night at 7, here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
Listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is